ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्य ज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Welcome back to ISKCON of Silicon Valley. I'm very happy to be here, as tonight we have an opportunity to speak about Krishna's instructions in the Bhagavad Gita and about Krishna himself. And according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, any questions or answers that are related to Krishna leads one to the absolute truth. In fact, we can note that in his last days, Parikshit Maharaj, who had 7 days to live, engaged in a conversation with Shukadev Goswami, and it was comprised of questions and answers. And they were all directed towards understanding what is the duty of a person who is about to die. And rather than being frightening, such a conversation actually gives us calm and teaches us composure amidst what is sometimes compared to a raging ocean. The material world itself can be fearsome because we don't know where the shore is or how to get there exactly. And in any moment we face apparent annihilation. So it's relevant to everybody in this world. This conversation between Krishna and Arjuna, which took place 5,000 years ago, is as relevant today as it ever was for all those reasons. So we'll go a little bit into the Bhagavad Gita today and also talk about some of the daily meditations that we can have in order to be enlivened in the practice of bhakti. Does that sound okay? I offer my respectful obeisances to my spiritual master, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and to all of you, because you are Vaishnavas and therefore the most worshipable in the three worlds. Hare Krishna. So the practice of bhakti yoga is the topmost system because it teaches to awaken our original love for Krishna. In this world, we can notice that people actually work for loving relationships. Without relationships, people aren't really motivated to work in the world. And we're satisfied when we feel that we have loving reciprocation with others. This is because our eternal nature is that we have kinship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead and all His parts and parcels, the other living entities. And in the material world, we have what's an opposite of the spiritual world, because this is a reflection. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks in this 15th chapter about the nature of this world, when he says, Urdva mulamada shakam ashvatam prahar avyayam chandamsi yasya parnani yastam vedas avedavit. So he's describing the material world, and he says it's like a tree, and then he tells how the roots are coming up, the branches are down, and then he goes on to explain how this material world is a reflected image of the spiritual world. And whatever is reflected is something that we can't really enjoy. Although it looks just like the original thing, there's no substance to it. So the substance that we're actually craving, says Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is prema, or love for Krishna. And that can be awakened by the practice of bhakti yoga. Especially there are tenets such as chanting the names of the Lord that we just did. And by chanting Krishna's names, we're not just reminded of Krishna, but we're filled up by His loving energy. The kind of chanting that we do was passed down to us by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Actually, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is noted by the Gaudiya Acharyas to be the incarnation of Krishna in the Kali Yuga. Normally, in every yuga, there's an appearance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead as an avatar to help make the world right. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam srijamyaham. That I come again and again to this world to help establish dharma. And he comes at regular intervals. So in this particular age, Kali Yuga, which started about 5,000 years ago, the special incarnation that would come at this time and teach the Yuga Dharma would normally be an empowered representative of the Lord. However, this particular Kali Yuga, Krishna appears himself, but he comes as also the Yuga avatar, because he had his own reasons for coming, did Krishna, which are explained in the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. They're very esoteric reasons. However, we get the benefit of this because Krishna comes as his own devotee in the form of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and then he distributes this prema, which is the goal of life. This was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teaching, prema pumarta mahan, that the ultimate goal of life is this prema or love for God. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he appeared in what is now West Bengal, in the holy dam called Navadvip. It's nine islands, Navadvip. There's rivers, the Ganga goes through everywhere and divides it up into nine islands. These nine islands represent the nine processes of bhakti. So those are Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, Parasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam. Beginning with hearing, chanting, remembering, serving the lotus feet of the Lord, of worshiping the Lord, of remembering the Lord, offering everything to the Lord. Did I miss any? Serving the lotus feet, padasevanam. So these are the nine processes of devotional service that are represented there in Navadvip Dham. That's the nine islands. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared there, his mother and father were brahmanas, and when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared, he was accompanied by the chanting of the holy name, because at the time he appeared, there was a lunar eclipse. Have any of you ever been in India at the time of a lunar eclipse? What did you all do during the eclipse? Anything special? Well, normally people go into the Ganga. I was there once many years ago, in the 1970s, I guess there was a lunar eclipse. And we all went in the Ganga. We stayed in there till it was over. And we all chanted the holy names. And that's what everyone did when Lord Chaitanya appeared in the world during the lunar eclipse. So Krishna has a way of arranging things in the world. He's the best arranger there is, because he knows what's going on everywhere all the time. He's omnipotent and omniscient. So he arranged that the lunar eclipse would be there at his birth, which means that everybody would be chanting the holy names. And you could hear it everywhere. This is the precursor to the Sankirtan movement. He made this arrangement. Another way that he brought the holy name into the world was when he was a little child. When he was on the lap of his mother, he'd cry, but he'd only stop when she and the other women and devotees would chant Hare Krishna. And then he'd immediately stop. He'd be pacified. Have you ever seen a baby like this? Yes. I saw one on the internet recently. There was some devotee child that's very similar, right? You saw that? So, little Nimai, that was his name when he was named Nimai. He was born under a neem tree. And they would chant Hare Krishna, he would stop. And he was so charming when they would see him. Everyone would come to see him. In fact, it's mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that devas were coming in disguise to visit this baby and bring him gifts from everywhere. So As Nimai grew up, he began to exhibit these extraordinary signs of scholarship as a young child. Of course, before that, he exhibited extreme signs of rascaldom. As a small child, he used to create havoc. He would go up and down the Ganges. At that time, brahmanas would be there doing their daily ablutions. They would sit on the bank of the Ganges. They would say their prayers. They would have their achman cups. They would have everything in order. And then they'd go in for their dip. And Nimai would come out. He would mix up all their clothes. You know, put one person's clothes with somebody else's. So when they'd come out, they would all be tangled up and lost. He would also emerge from the water, and he would spit a mouthful of water onto the sacred place where they were doing their pujas and disturb them. And he and his friends would go on rampages where they would go to a neighbor's house and they would tie the door shut. That time there were only outhouses. They didn't have bathrooms indoors. And people couldn't get out of the house. So they would be locked in because Nimai and his friends locked them in. And sometimes he and his friends would put on the uniform of a bull, two of them together, and then they would go into their crop fields and start wrecking everything, and the people come running out after them. This way, he showed his rascaldom when he was a young child, and then he emerged as the greatest of scholars. No one could defeat him. His teacher considered that this was the most intelligent boy he'd ever met. In fact, Nimai began to develop a following. A lot of students wanted to be his student, and he became a prominent teacher even when he was young, and would regularly defeat any of the older boys in logic. And in fact, the culmination of this in Navadvip was when the Digvijay Pandit, who's a real character, actually. He was traveling all over India. He had a benediction from Saraswati that whatever he said would be blessed by her. Therefore, he would defeat everyone in debate. In fact, people were so afraid of him that they would either leave town before he'd get there, or they'd just sign a sheet, which would say that I've been defeated by the Digvijay. And when Digvijay was coming to Navadvip Dham, and Nimai Pandit was exhibiting this great scholarship, and all the other scholars in Navadvip decided on some pretense that they had to leave town because they didn't want to stay for the Digvijay and be embarrassed. But Nimai, because he was so cool, he stayed there with all his students around him on the bank of the Ganges. And you can imagine the scene that he's sitting, speaking to them, and then the Digvijay comes and sees the beauty of Nimai Pandit sitting amidst his students on the bank of the Ganges. And he felt a little fear, did the Digvijay Pandit, when he first saw Nimai, because there's this weightiness to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that even though those who are ignorant of his real nature, they can feel. And Nimai greeted him very warmly and then asked him to compose some verses glorifying Mother Ganges, which Digvijay did. Now, when Radhika Raman was here, he told us about one of his professors. You know, it's hard nowadays to imagine someone on the spot composing 100 Sanskrit verses just extemporaneously, isn't it? But every age is not like the age we're in now, with televisions being on back of every airplane seat and all everything truncated the way it's presented through the news. People actually had time to develop their minds, and they lived in a pristine environment. And there were scholars that had great powers of recollection and so forth. And so the Digvijay Pandit, when he was asked by Nimai to recite verses about Mother Ganges, immediately composed them just in his mind. and apparently perfect Sanskrit verses and just recited them. As the author of Chaitanya Bhagavat says, just like the blowing wind. And after everyone heard them, they were astonished. But then Nimai said, now let's analyze them. Let's see what are the embellishments, what are the beautiful parts of this poetry, and also let's look at the faults. Now imagine, here's this young boy, and here's the Digvijaya, he's never lost. So this was a problem because he had pride, and this happens when we become really successful sometimes, not you, when one becomes very successful, not that you're not successful, I'm just saying you don't become full of pride when you are successful, but it's natural, it's when you're winning over and over again and people saying, oh, you're great, that pride can creep in. And this had infected the Digvijaya Pandit. That's why he couldn't understand who Nimai actually was. He was proud. And so he protested. He said, how could you possibly analyze my poetry? You don't know this level of composition. You're at a very elementary level. And Nimai said, well, I've heard about it, so I can, how to do these things, so I can do it. And then Nimai took out one of the verses amidst the hundred and just remembered it and recited it as the pundit had given it. And the pundit was surprised. He said, how did you remember that? And he said, oh, some people like you, you have this power, but I just have this, I'm a Shruti Dar, I can remember things, that's all. Then he began to analyze the verse. And he said, here are the good qualities, and here are where you made mistakes. And as he began to describe the mistakes, the Digvijaya Pandit was mortified, but he couldn't say anything. First of all, because the points Nimai was making were valid, and second of all, we find out later that Saraswati, who is his worshipful goddess, was not comfortable allowing him to speak up in front of Nimai, because that's her worshipable Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the students around the encampment then began to laugh because they saw that Nimai had just soundly defeated this very puffed up pundit who travels all over India defeating everybody else. But he stopped them. Nimai said, don't laugh. He's a great personality. And when Digvijaya heard that and went off to take rest for the night, he was thinking over and over again, what had happened? How had I been defeated so soundly? How's my reputation now been crushed by this young boy? And he was thinking of his goddess, Saraswati, that she has forsaken me. But in a dream, she revealed that actually, I've not forsaken you, but both of us were in the company of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, I was not able to empower you before my worshipable Lord. And she revealed to him that actually he's your worshipable Lord too. And when Digvijaya saw that, the next day he went back to Nimai Pandit and took shelter of him, offered his prayers. Nimai said, what is this? You're a great pundit. But he took him under his shelter, and Digvijaya Pandit then gave up the trappings of a great conqueror. He had elephants and all kinds of followers. He left them behind and he went and wandered by himself. So deeply was he affected by the audience of having the occasion to meet Nimai Pandit and be in his presence and to be defeated by him. So sometimes when we have reversals in our life where we feel that we've made a grave error, something went really wrong, or that we're incapable, this is actually a healthy experience, because when we're infected by the idea that I'm great, it's very difficult to make spiritual advancement. And I was just reading today that a person who's spiritually advancing, and if you can bring me the Madhya Lila, chapter 23, the verse that begins, Shantir Avyartam Kalatvam. Shantir is spelled K-S. Shantir. K-S. Shantir Avyarta Kalatvam. These are mentioning, this is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu speaking about the qualities of somebody whose heart is beginning to soften in love of God by practicing bhakti yoga. And the first is called shantir, or forgiveness, which means that person becomes very forgiving of the situations of life that come upon him or her. And the example that's given here, it may not be the 23rd chapter, verse 89, 23, 18. Okay, just find it and tell him. Thanks. And tell him what to put up. 23, 18, and 19. It's like Wi-Fi. When you're too far away from the Wi-Fi, you don't get the signal. Now we had a Wi-Fi accelerator in the middle. These are important. These are qualities you look for when you're advancing in devotional service. The beginning of the practice of devotional service is characterized by what's called shraddha. So shraddha means the awakening of faith. This is the most precious commodity, because actually, yadrishi yadrishi shraddha shadhir bhavati tadrishi. This is, you can come closer. Find a seat, come up. This is described in the Sri Brahma Samhita, is it not? Everyone recognizes the verse? Yadrishi, yadrishi, shraddha, siddhir, bhavati, tadrishi. So it means that the more you advance in spiritual life, that it actually means the more that your shraddha, your faith, is thickening. So it really means that shraddha is given an exact definition. Shraddha, shabde, vishwas, kahi, sudri, danishtray, krishne, bhakti, koila, sarva, karma, krita, hoy. Which means that you have this abiding feeling that all your fortune comes from doing devotional service. Everything else is just superfluous extra. You do it dutifully, but it's really not that important. What's really, really important is doing your duty to worship Krishna. Coming to the temple, that's important. Chanting your japa, finishing, that's important. And you start to see that from doing bhakti, everything good comes. And everything will be taken care of properly. Krishna assures this also again and again in the Bhagavad Gita. Of one of the famous verses, he says at the end of the verse, he's telling Arjuna, just forget everything else and surrender to me. What if Krishna told you that? What would you do? Just say right now, I'd forget everything and just surrender to him. So he says, just surrender to me, don't worry. And he says, Masu Chaha. He said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. So this is faith. You understand Krishna's there. And also at the same time, there's a sense that the material world's not dependable at all. In the Bhagavatam, we find that Shukadeva Goswami's teaching Parikshit Maharaj at the outset of the Bhagavatam, don't trust the material world. Don't think that you're going to find some safe position here. So he says, Deha patra kala tradeshu atma saini sa satsapi tesham pramatu nidhanam pashyanapina pashyati. He said, you're taking your body as your protector. My body's strong, I'm healthy, I'll be okay. Then he said, okay, then you have your family members, your wife, your kids, all your relatives, and you think they'll protect me. But he says, don't believe it. They're fallible soldiers. Soldiers they are. They'll fight for you for a while. But they can't stand up to the material nature. Sometimes they don't even try to stand up to the material nature. So don't take shelter there. And Prahlad Maharaj says a similar thing. This is a thread that runs throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam. Don't put your faith in the material nature. I read the other day, Prabhupada said, material nature is so cruel. He uses the word cruel. He said that at any minute, it can take away your happy existence. You think, I'm happy in this body. I just got a new car. Everything's fine. But it's so cruel. It's unceremonious. You know the word unceremonious? When material nature comes to repossess whatever you have, it's unceremonious. It's not like, you know, I'm really sorry about this. No, it's just cut. So Prahlad Maharaj says, Balasya neha sharanam pitarao nashingha nartasya chagana buddhambati majato now taptasya tat prativedir yari hanji sheshtas tavad vibho tanubitam twadupekshitanam. I kind of messed up the last line, but the point is that he says, analyze how you can't protect your own children because they're at the mercy of material nature also. You do the best you can, but you can't really protect them in the end. And he says a doctor can't save you with his medicine because if you ask him, is this really going to work? You say, well, it's worked in a few studies, but we're not sure why it works or whether it will work on you. And you also can't save a drowning man with a boat because unless Krishna sanctions it, it could go wrong. My father, my grandfather, or his great-grandfather, was on the Titanic. But he got off before it sank. That's why I'm here to give this class. So we're at the mercy of material nature, says the Bhagavatam. Therefore, understand that Krishna is your protector. And only he can save you at any time. This means faith. And this is the awakening also, the Shraddha, of interest in bhakti. It seems interesting to you. It seems like a good idea. Like you see devotees chanting and you go like, God, why didn't I think of that earlier? You know, I should be dedicated to something. And this looks, you recognize there's a tradition here. You recognize that people here are serious about practicing spiritual life, and you think, yeah, I'd like to do that too. This is Shraddha. This is awakening of Shraddha, and this is good fortune. It means you've got an asset that a lot of other people don't have when that awakens. And from that Shraddha comes the desire to be around devotees called sadhusanga. I want to be part of the devotees. Whatever they're doing, I'm going to do. And from that, you get introduced to the process of advancing in devotional service. And this means you take up some kind of practice. And the devotees will tell you, do it like this, don't do it like that. And you can get special help. You start to hear from the scriptures. And they guide you in ways. And then the devotees, who become your teachers, they tell you how to advance in devotional service. And then you go through your own process of purification. And then at a certain point of purification, you come to the stage of steadiness, where you can't be affected by the unwanted desires that used to be there. They become muted. Then comes an actual powerful taste for chanting Hare Krishna and for hearing about Krishna in the Bhagavatam. It becomes irresistible. And then comes attachment, which is a very coveted stage of devotional service where you start to think, Krishna is mine. And this is your whole life is your attachment to Krishna. And then comes bhava. The heart is described in the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, it begins to melt. And it's touched by a ray of the internal potency of the Lord. Then one can experience within one's own heart the taste of the relationship with Krishna in the spiritual world, in this bhava stage. Now, meanwhile, of course, anyone can say anything. If you ask somebody, how advanced are you in devotional service? I could just say, well, I was dancing with Krishna about an hour ago. You should have been here. And how are you going to dispute that? I'm asking seriously. Of course, I wasn't saying it seriously, but you won't be able to. However, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives these symptoms to show what you'll be able to see in yourself or in others who are advancing in devotional service, and he gives many examples that go along with them. So the first one's called Shantir. Everyone say. So this means forgiveness. And the example that goes along with Shantir is that Parikshit Maharaj was cursed to die in 7 days. Well, how would that make you feel? Like on any ordinary Wednesday afternoon, if somebody curses you to die in 7 days and you know it's going to come to pass. Feel good about it? Well, he felt okay about it. He said, this is very good. Sadhaname, he said, oh, very good. This is a good thing. He said, because I'm so attached to my kingdom, to my family, to this whole material world, that Krishna's come to get me. And here it came. And this is one of the symptoms of somebody who's advancing in devotional service in general, is seeing Krishna's hand in everything. Because obviously the world's going to move against our plan. Anybody here have any plans? The world will move against them, and you'll take it, we'll take it as, oh, things are going wrong. But they're just moving. I have my plan. Like, I always think about the times when the earthquakes have come here to California. We wouldn't even notice unless we had brittle little houses everywhere. So similarly, we have brittle little plans that we set up, and then when the world moves, we think, oh, this is a disaster. It's not really a disaster. Things are just moving the way they're supposed to move. You're set up in the wrong place, that's all. So Shantir means that you develop this acceptance of the Lord's will in everything, and you become very forgiving. And this is a symptom of a softening heart. The heart has become soft and pliable. And then the next one is called Avyarta Kalatvam, say. So Avyarta Kalatvam means that a person who is advancing in devotional service and the heart is becoming soft doesn't want to waste even a moment. He or she is constantly engaged in devotional service, just like people in some countries, they smoke a lot of cigarettes. And there's a phenomenon called chain smoking. Have you ever heard of this? So how do you do that? You never miss a puff, because you had a cigarette going, and then before it goes out, you don't throw it and then 2 minutes later pull out. No, no, no. Before it goes out, you light the next cigarette, and then you put it in your mouth, then you can throw the other one. And then you keep going. So this is called chain smoking. So devotees on the spiritual side, they're chain hearing and chanting, Shravanam Kirtanam. They don't put the one book down until they have some other thing lined up. They don't want a break. And this is natural. Even in the spiritual world, the devotees don't want to be separated from Krishna, even for a moment. And this is the yearning of the soul. We're part and parcel of Krishna. And being in his proximity, thinking of him, being engaged in his service one way or another, this is the actual satisfaction of the heart. And as much as we experience in this world not wanting to be separated from a loved one, although we are from time to time, or inevitably we are, that sort of emotion that we feel there, that's the kind of emotion that devotees feel when they're advancing in devotional service, only multiplied many, many times, and they're feeling that same kind of angst for being close to Krishna and always hearing and chanting about Krishna. And the example given here, Avyarta Kalatvam, is also Parikshit Maharaj. Because when Parikshit Maharaj was cursed to die, he said, okay, sadhu, very good. And then he said, I don't mind, all of you simply go on chanting and hearing about the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because I don't want to waste any time right now. He's shown as the example for this, that I won't stop, lament, think about anything else. Just go on hearing and chant. And this is actually the solution to all problems in our lives, is to become more aligned with the process of hearing and chanting and stay closer to Krishna. Now comes virakti. Virakti, please say. Virakti means detachment from those things that are not related to Krishna. Name three things that you can think of that are absolutely not related to Krishna. Of course, you can relate everything to Krishna, and don't tell me that. Just tell me three things that are absolutely unrelated to Krishna. What? Computer, okay. Yes? A what ceremony? What is that? A mundane cinema, yeah. And I would say giant stadium. Yesterday we drove by it, right? And I was looking, it's bigger than any temple I've seen in modern day history. It cost billions of dollars to build Giants Stadium. And if there are any Giants fans, please forgive me. I know this is sacrilegious to even say this. But the fact is, it's an utter waste of time. It's actually ludicrous. Sorry. But it is. It's a huge monument to wasting time and grown men running around with uniforms that they made up. I mean, if you look at it in an isolated way, it's like, what are you wearing that for? It's like, we made it up, and this is our paradigm. And the ball gets hit around, and there's fights break out, and people spend billions of dollars to advertise because everyone's watching it. This is a royal waste of time. And those who taste even a tiny bit of this attachment to Krishna, these things become vapor. They're not interesting anymore. That they're not, they're actually become ludicrous. It's not part of their frame of reference anymore. These kinds of games and topics that aren't related to Krishna. And this is a sense that one will get when one's advancing in devotional service. And the example given in the Srimad Bhagavatam is that of a person who's very hungry and who eats a good meal. When one eats a good meal, naturally, he or she feels satisfaction, nourishment, and hunger subsides. Correct? And similarly, the Bhagavatam says, Bhakti parishanu bhavo viraktir anyata traisha trika eka kala. When you come close to Krishna through bhakti, then naturally you'll develop these three things that are compared to nourishment, satisfaction, and your hunger going away. So the first thing is bhakti. You'll start to awaken your natural sense that I like Krishna. I love Krishna. I want to be with Krishna. And anuraga means that then you'll start to see Krishna within everything. He'll become present before you wherever you look. And the third thing is virakti anyatatra, which means all other things that aren't related to your practice of devotional service and your connection to Krishna become wholly uninteresting. And this virakti cannot really be faked. It's either there or it's not there. So we note this in ourselves, that am I advancing in devotional service? How uninterested am I becoming in things that aren't related to Krishna? And of course, the positive side is there. How much am I interested in hearing about Krishna? These are the first three, and we'll take a few reflections before we go on, or questions to expand the... Yes?
I had a question in regards to steadiness.
Yes.
So I notice in our attempt to become steady, we're plagued with the disease of unsteadiness. So how does one go beyond this unsteadiness to come to the platform of being completely steady? Does that make sense?
Well, it's kind of like saying, like with any discipline, you say you have to start off bad before you can get good. Otherwise, where are you going to start? Nobody starts as an expert pianist. You have to peck away at the keys, and you have to look really carefully at the book, and you have to make all kinds of mistakes. And as you do, you start to get better. So how do you do it? By practice. And that's why we practice devotional service. And as we do, we become more and more attached to the process of devotional service, and we also become more expert.
Hi, Hare Krishna.
Hare
Thanks
Krishna.
For the opportunity for the question. So I have two questions, but yes. I'll probably just ask one.
Okay.
So I have a question regarding why being Giant Stadium or being an athlete is not related to Krishna, because Krishna himself used to play a lot of games that is mentioned.
That's why I gave a bit of a disclaimer at the beginning. that anything ultimately can be related to Krishna. And I said, don't bring that in, because I'm just looking from the point of view of somebody who doesn't have that vision that you do. You know, we can do that with anything, because ultimately everything comes from Krishna and everything is related to Krishna, and your point's well taken. But I was making another point, and that is, in a certain kind of consciousness, I don't see that it's related to Krishna. For instance, the thousands of people are going to the, I won't mention the giants, because I don't want to make a big offense here in California. Anybody going to see any sports team, generally speaking, unless they're already trained in the science of Krishna consciousness or they're enlightened being, they're not thinking about God. They're thinking about the players and so forth. So the definition given in the Srimad Bhagavatam of maya, or illusion, is given by Krishna himself to Brahma. He says, Ritirtam yat pratyeta na pratyeta chatmani tadvidya atmano mayam yatabhaso yatatamaha. Whatever you see in the world that you think has no relationship to me, know that's my illusory energy. So you're right. Everything, including the giants, can be connected to Krishna. In fact, we could write a book about a metaphor, an extended metaphor, about how the giants are representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And, you know, you could go through a lot of baseball analogies, and people have before done things like that and related it, you know, connected it back to Krishna. Once you do that, then it comes back. The spiritual quality comes back. And this is what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. Paramarpanam brahmahavira brahmagnau brahmanohutam brahmaina brahmaiva tena gantavyam brahmakarma samadhina. And that is that anything in this world that's so-called material that you engage in the service of the Supreme Brahman, that also takes on the quality of Brahman, because actually it ultimately all comes from him. And so matter is spirit covered over by ignorance. Remove the ignorance and the spiritual quality comes back.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yes. So if I say I want to practice yoga, right, because Krishna himself was called Yogeshwar, right, improve the strength of my body and become a supreme athlete and do good for the God, then I can make spiritual advancement in my life with this goal, right?
Yeah, a lot of it, as you know well, depends on your motive. I mean, you know, you can develop your body and so forth. You can even do so-called good for others. I just saw yesterday that someone was suing an insurance company because they gave somebody $33,000, and the person was a drug addict, so he killed himself with drugs. And now the family is saying, why'd you give him the money? They were thinking, well, we're doing him a favor. So why am I doing yoga? To get strong and healthy and be beautiful or whatever? I can, as the, you know, the principle can be applied in the opposite way too. I can do something that appears to be spiritual, but with the wrong motive. And in which case, that also becomes contaminated. And it becomes a material activity, because actually I'm doing it because I want to, you know, be famous myself, not make God famous. Duryodhan made a huge feast for Krishna. You know this, you know Mahabharata. Duryodhan made a big feast for Krishna. And why did he cook the big feast? He didn't love Krishna. He just wanted to impress him. And he wanted to woo him that he wanted to have more people on his side. And Krishna wouldn't eat it. He wouldn't even take his food. But then he went, did Krishna, to the house of Vidura. And there they were so ecstatic that Krishna had come to their house that they were trying to feed him, and they were peeling bananas, because that's all they had on hand at the time. And instead of giving him the bananas, they gave him the banana peels. Because they were flustered to see the Supreme. They loved him so much. And Krishna accepted that. So the motive is important. Duryodhan is you know, doing so many things. He was actually a great king. He knew the Vedas. So did Jarasandha. Jarasandha was a great king. He worshipped all the devas, but he hated Krishna. So, you know, it depends on your motive. That's the important point.
Yeah, totally understood and agreed. So thanks for the clarification. And if we have time, I want to ask a question on the kshama. So
yes.
There's a saying in Sanskrit that kshama virasya bhushanam, right? That means forgiveness suits to the brave, right?
Suits to?
The one who is brave.
brave.
So for instance, a sheep says, okay, I'm forgiving lion, right? So then that's not a valid kshama because he or she is in no position to forgive lion, right? Because it does not even have capability. So sometimes in your life, if you're faced with the situation that when you know you are right, right? So at that time, what is the right thing to do? To stand your ground and fight on the merit of the spiritual consciousness or to forgive and let go?
Oh, what a good topic. Thank you for bringing it up. And it's a subject that we talk about a lot. And it's important also, the points that you brought up, because when we practice spiritual life, and let's say forgiveness in particular, there are two platforms of existence to consider. One is that, first of all, we live in a bi-dimensional universe. This universe is filled up with living entities who are animating material bodies. And they also have a certain psychology, and they have different cultures and societies. And their duties in relationship to the body and the mind and the society is different from their spiritual duty. So one is called paramartika, our ultimate goal in life, and how we act on the spiritual platform. And the other is called vyavaharika, how we interact with normal human society, let's say. So I'm just painting with a broad brush to get to a finer point. So now let's say that you're a devotee. I mean, you are, so we don't have to say it, but you know, you are a devotee. So let's say a person's going to get a job and they're educated in the spiritual science. They understand I'm not my body. And where am I from, actually? Spiritual world. I'm just here temporarily. And so they go for an interview, job interview, and the interviewer says, so, where are you from? They say, I'm not from this world. I'm not my body. Actually, I'm from the spiritual world. And they're like, okay, go ahead, you're out. This isn't proper behavior for a spiritual person, especially unless they're in the last stage of life where they want nothing to do with human society at all. There's a way in which we have some responsibility to act in a reasonable way in the vyavaharika existence that we have in this world. At the same time, we go on cultivating Krishna consciousness. So how does this relate to forgiveness? The two ideas aren't mutually exclusive. That is, if somebody offends you or does some harm to you, internally, you can forgive them. Externally, you may have to do your due diligence and go through a process to make sure that they're maybe even prosecuted. But that doesn't mean that you can't forgive them internally. Because there's a vyavaharika, you have a duty externally to do, and there's the paramartika, you have a responsibility to keep fixed on the ultimate goal of life. The reason that people in the very elementary levels of learning to forgive do so is for their own good. Because there's an old saying that holding a grudge against somebody and not forgiving them is like drinking poison and hoping the other person dies. You drink the poison and you hope they die. How does it hurt them for you to hold a grudge against them? It doesn't. So it's for your own good to give it up. And forgiveness becomes even more profound for those who are spiritually advancing because they see several things. One thing is described in the Shruti Shastras, Smriti Shastras, that says the whole world is working in a uniform way. Everybody's getting exactly what they deserve. So who is there to judge that process? In other words, somebody is getting the results exactly of what they deserved from their previous activities. And one who sees that the world's working uniformly and in a completely reasonable way, and that Krishna is the perfect moral agent, there's nothing being perpetrated on somebody arbitrarily, it's coming because of Krishna's mercy, will be very observant of this and not be hyper critical or come into a victim mode and hold on to resentment against people. Thank you for your excellent questions. Thank you.
Thanks for the explanation.
Shraddha Devi Dasi has a few comments from the internet. One.
This is Vaikuntha Nayak Das from India.
Vaikuntha Nayak Prabhu, calling in from South India.
I like your analogy of the chain smoker. Just as a chain smoker does not put down his cigarette without lighting another cigarette, a devotee does not put down a book without getting another book.
Yep, that's a good analogy. And these kinds of analogies are given all the time by the Goswamis. They talk about ways in which you can see the crossover between the material attachment, how it resembles actual spiritual attachment, because ultimately real advancement in spiritual life means this intense desire to serve Krishna. When that awakens within one's heart, intense desire to hear about Krishna, to serve Krishna, all things related to Krishna become interesting to the person, and the whole world becomes a place of fortune because it's unlimited service for Krishna. It's a very enlivening awakening of fortune in the heart of the devotee. It's all auspicious. So, for instance, Rupa Goswami says that he gives a prayer. He says, just as young boys are naturally attracted to young girls, and young girls are naturally attracted to young boys, no training necessary. Similarly, he said, let me be attracted to you, Krishna. Same way, spontaneously. Yuvatinam yata yuni yunam chau yuvatau yata mano binamate tadvan mano me ramatam twayi. Let my mind be like that, so attached to you, spontaneously. It's not like I'm thinking about it. I'm not doing it out of duty. I'm just go there immediately. This means actual recovery of spiritual health, that one becomes immediately attracted upon hearing about Krishna, seeing Krishna, anything related to Krishna. The devotee wants to be there constantly. And he also gives another example, and that is that the lover is waiting for a note. And nowadays it would be an email. But in the old days, people used to send love notes, and they would come in the mail. So nowadays, people check their emails like 100 times a day, or WhatsApp, or Facebook. It's like, did it come? You know, it's like, no, it wasn't there 10 seconds, or maybe it is now. That's sort of, if anybody's ever experienced that, like in the old days, the note would come, they'd look in the mailbox, and even before that, it would be delivered by some, person in a carriage or something. And, the note finally comes. Imagine what that's like. And then the person who's anticipating, their hands are going like this. And they open, what's she going to say, She loves me, she loves me not. it's like total anxiety. And then it's like, oh my God, and tears are coming. And this whole experience, so in the Padyavali, there's this verse, in the same way, let me feel like that reading Srimad Bhagavatam. Let me have the same anticipation. Srimad Bhagavatam is one long love letter. It's all about the love of the devotees for Krishna. That's why even Krishna wants to hear it. He's utterly attracted to that because it's that love letter from the spiritual world. All the songs, all the verses, everything is meant to bring us to that. So the Goswamis are saying, let me be similarly affected like that. Yes.
So Maharaj, I was thinking about how amazing devotional service is. You had mentioned that as a person increases in advances in devotional service, then his faith also increases. Although when you progress in devotional service, you get the tests become harder, and there could be more difficulties coming your way. And yet, like Kunti Maharani, really liked that because of her advancement in devotional service.
Yeah, that's true. That Kunti Devi prayed like that, Vipara Sant Tashasvat Tatra Tatra Jagaguru Bhavato Darshanam Yatsyat Apunar Bhavadarshanam. Apunar Bhavadarshanam means to see something, right? So what is it she's saying? Apunar Bhavadarshanam, I won't have darshan with birth and death anymore. I won't be seeing this anymore. Why? Because Vipara Sant Tashasvat, she says, let troubles come into my life. Let disaster come. Because whenever it comes, then that's when I really call out to Krishna. That's the time. And you'll notice this. you'll notice that when you have the deepest trouble in your life, or somebody really chastises you, you're flying high, and you think, you know, who is better than me? And the next thing, you get some heavy chastisement from somebody you respect, and then suddenly, you're crushed. And then where do you go? If you're a devotee, you take shelter of Krishna. Of course I'm fallen. I'm, you know, let me start over. I'm nobody. And then you're chanting. It actually becomes sweet. It's like I'm just a servant. That's where you take shelter. So Kunti's saying this, Vipara Santatasa Tatra Tatra Jagaguru. My Lord, let these heavy disasters come upon me again and again. Do you pray like that? No. Kunti did. You know, that was her mood. In fact, you'll find the Bhagavatamrita, the Yadus, you know, they're all out planning, like how to make some artificial disaster just so Krishna would come back and be with them. And so, yeah, this is a really good point. Yes.
I liked listening to the pastime of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Keshav Kashmiri, which you just mentioned. And I noted that, I was just thinking that Krishna doesn't like pride in his devotees at all. And one more thing which I really like, that Mahaprabhu made sure that that Pandit was not dishonored in public. He, like, you know, he made that.
Yes. And this all, Krishna's our best friend. He actually cares about us. And he does things in a way to reform us that they're so sweet and perfect. It may not feel like that at the moment, but a similar thing happened with Indra. You know this from the pastime of the devastating rainfall in Vrindavan, right? Vrindavan. So Krishna just finished instructing some villagers nearby about the importance of devotional service and spontaneous love for him. Because he had, with his coward boys, when walking through the forest, received from them an urgent request. And they said, "My dear Krishna and Balaram, we're very, very hungry. Let's get some food." And so Krishna told them that nearby here in this village, there are brahmanas, and they're getting ready to perform a big yajna. And it's a big deal, you know, the brahmanas, the big belly, and they have the brahmin's thread, and they know every mantra, and everything has to be perfect. And sometimes, any priest in any religious practice, they begin to think, like, I'm the center of everything. I'm making this whole thing happen. And without me, how would it happen? And so, there they were. And it was the coward boys who then went to ask them, on behalf of Krishna and Balaram, they said, "My dear earthly lords," they offered obeisances. They said, "Krishna and Balaram are nearby, and they're very hungry." In fact, Krishna had told them, he said, "Don't ask in my name, because I'm a Vaishya. Ask in the name Balaram, he's a Kshatriya." Of course, they didn't do that. They just said, "Krishna and Balaram." And they asked, and you know what the brahmanas did? What did they do? Huh? Nothing. They said nothing. They didn't say one word. They just ignored them. I mean, that's the worst thing you can do. If you ever run Sankirtan, you're distributing books, and somebody that just pretends you don't exist, that's the healthiest medicine you can take in this world. You know, somebody just pretends you don't exist. Then you feel like, okay, yeah, that's how I've been treating Krishna all these years. So then they came back and they said, "Krishna, Balaram, you know, they didn't give us anything. They didn't even speak to us." And Krishna said, "You don't worry. This is the way of begging. When you beg, you expect that people may not give." In fact, we find this in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. If beggars knew how hard it was to give, they wouldn't beg. And if givers knew how hard it was to beg, they'd always give. But then they said, "Now," did Krishna and Balaram, "you go to the wives of the brahmanas." Now, these are very special women. They were serving their husbands, and they were helping to set up the yajnas. And one of their duties was to go shopping regularly to get the ingredients for the yajna. And some of the salespeople, those that were doing barter at that time, they were pure devotees, residents of Vrindavan. They had betel nut, they had flowers. And just in their exchanges, they would discuss Krishna, and they started to hear things about Krishna. This is the power of hearing. So much so that these wives, although they'd never met Krishna before in their lives, just by hearing about them from the pure devotees, their hearts started to change. And this is the process of bhakti. It's mentioned in the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam by Kapila Devi. He says, Satam basangam mamavirya samvido bhavanti hritkarna rasayana kata tajjoshanarashu apavarga vartmani shadaratir bhaktir anukramishriti. If you want to know step by step how to make advancement in bhakti yoga, here's your guidebook in one verse. It says, by hearing in the association of sadhus, then you'll make step-by-step advancement to the highest stage of devotional service. So these women were spontaneously attracted to hearing about Krishna. So now the coward boys came in to see the wives of the Brahmins, and they offered their obeisances, and they only were able to utter half of what the message was, that Krishna's nearby in the forest and he's hungry. And before they could say anything, the women dropped everything they were doing for the yajna, everything they were doing for their husbands, and they started gathering together all the food that was meant for the yajna and taking it straight to the forest as fast as they could go. This is the nature of somebody who has spontaneous love for Krishna. And there's a heart-rending description of how Krishna and the wives of the Brahmins meet in the forest, and as Krishna within the heart is embracing them internally as they're beholding him in the forest. And there's a dialogue there that you can read that's extremely instructive and touching at the same time. So let me just close this point. What point was I making? And that is that the process of advancement in devotional service begins by the association of devotees, and it can come to its fruition just by hearing about Krishna from them. Shraddha. Bhaktin Shraddha.
I really like the point that you made about how we can measure our spiritual progress by seeing how detached we are from material activities. So if I do recognize that I am getting attracted to things that are not related to Krishna, what's the next step after that? Do I suppress my feelings towards those things, or do I give in to them?
The first thing is don't be surprised, because we've been in the material world since the time immemorial, and therefore the attraction that we have for the material world is absolutely natural in one way. It's one way it's completely unnatural because we're spiritual beings. But as the Hamsa Avatar explains in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the sense objects are embedded in the mind subtly, and we're intricately related to the material world. The process of devotional service goes in stages, and we have the Daivi Varnashrama in order to give a natural way of life for each person so they can live comfortably. Now, if you read in the 8th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada talks about how every person has to work from a position of strength, and everybody has a different natural position to work from. So it's sense gratification is like salt. You don't want too much, you don't want too little. It's also like cutting your nails. You don't want them too long, you can't cut them too short, or you're really going to suffer. So you have to be balanced. Krishna says, yukta hara viharasya, yukta cheshtasya karmasu, yukta swapna vabodasya, yoga bhavati dukkha. Be balanced, be sensible in the way that you eat, the way that you sleep, mate, defend, all these things, so that you can be strong enough to do devotional service. And fortunately, bhakti is so powerful that you can live a fairly normal life. I mean, most people won't be able to tell the difference. You're not going to move to the forest. You're not restricted in any way, because practically, you know, eating, sleeping, mating, defending, you can do those all in connection to Krishna. And those are the main aspects of sense gratification in the material world. So just make sure that you line them up in such a way that you're not disturbed in your practice of devotional service, that goes on. Because your life will change as you go through different phases. And if you're able to artfully and inventively practice devotional service in the various phases of your life while keeping some balance and keep the vibration going, then you'll come out of the material world unscathed, and you'll also go back to Godhead. Does that help? Okay. Prabhu. But don't suppress. We don't suppress, but we do. The main thing is that, of course, there are what Krishna calls regulative principles of freedom. First of all, the main regulations are always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. Everything else is meant to serve these two principles. There are, replacements for all the different kinds of sense gratification in the material world. One of the ones I found the most interesting, unfortunately, is the one people aren't that attached to, is gambling. Anybody? You don't want to admit it? Okay. Gambling is usually out of four regulative principles that we talk about very frequently, but devotees follow. Is Prabhupada said that the replacement for gambling is surrender to Krishna. It's much more exhilarating. Yes?
Prabhu, I want to discuss about the word virakti.
Okay.
So, I was in India recently and I was traveling through a lot of the temples. And one of the things that we discuss always is about the association of devotees, right? And there's a lot of devotees in the temples. And I was traveling and I was not able to find peace, even though in the association of those so-called devotees. The one time that I actually found peace was when I was able to sit down peacefully and do the chanting. And actually that's the most peaceful time. I'm alone by myself. I'm thinking of Krishna. I'm thinking of this Krishna. And I'm chanting and I'm very peaceful. Now, how is it that I'm not finding that same peace in the association of so many people?
So many who?
People. So many
people.
Devotees. Yeah.
Devotees?
Yeah.
I'd have to know a little more about what your definition of peace is and what you're looking for. You know, what is that experience that you're defining as peace?
Well, freedom from all the anxiety and worries of the material world, like the relationships and jobs and all sorts of stress in life. That doesn't bother me when I'm at peace, when I'm thinking of Krishna and I'm chanting. When I actually recently have been successfully doing 16 rounds every day, and I can tell from my personal experience that even though a few months ago I would think like, why 16, why not 17, or why not 15? But now that I'm doing it, I feel personally it's very satisfying to me, and it doesn't matter if 10 people agree or not agree with me, but it's very satisfying to me personally.
Are you feeling peaceful now?
Well, when I'm chanting, when I'm...
No, right now.
Right now, in this place, yes.
Yeah.
Because I'm listening to you and I'm...
Yeah, but you're around devotees right now, right? I mean...
Exactly.
And I don't know, I can't really make a general comment. I don't know the people or the devotees that you're associating with or the circumstances. I mean, at certain times we need different kinds of environments. There's times of the day. In the early morning, I also like to be alone. You know, I live in a separate place so I could just like concentrate and focus, and I don't want to be disturbed by anything. And I like to just, you know, and be quiet. And there are other times of the day I feel peaceful being around everybody. You know, like we have, like this. I feel peaceful right now, actually, even though, you know, and I was just at Google earlier and I felt peaceful there, too. Because, you know, we were around people, but we were talking about Krishna. So it felt nice. But there's different times of the day. Early morning, you treat differently maybe than the middle of the afternoon. And in the evening, maybe different. There's different times of the month. Like there's Ekadashi days. You might put more focus on days like Janmashtami and Gaur Purnima. All of us, you know, we set those days aside as special days. And there's times of the year like Kartik where we put, you know, special emphasis. Time of life also. If you can ascertain when you're getting near the end, which isn't always easy to do. But if you can ascertain, at least mathematically, when you're getting close to the end, you know, you can take more time to adjust. So everyone has to find, you know, the place where they can adjust and they can practice Krishna consciousness. It's not stereotype. Some people like to be alone more than others. Other people don't feel peaceful around everybody. So it's an individual thing. It's not stereotype that you have to fit in a certain way.
So it's not to say that you have to be around people all the time.
I wouldn't recommend it.
Just clarify.
You have to recreate yourself sometimes. You know, it's like it's really nice to just be alone and see if you can be with yourself and not have to reach out to somebody else, make another call. You know, it's like, how are you doing? Okay, what do you want? Nothing, I don't want to be alone. No, be alone and see what it's like. Krishna's always there in your heart. Once, Rompad Maharaj was my Sankirtan leader in New York City, and I used to work in the airport distributing books, so I came back, and it was changing, because it was time of year, I think around January, it was slowing down, so he said, go and traveling Sankirtan. And I said, okay, I'll go. Who am I going with? He said, by yourself. There's nobody else. I said, Maharaj, aren't you always supposed to go with somebody when you go in Sankirtan? And he said, Krishna's in your heart. Prabhupada said, Krishna's in your heart. I said, yeah, right. I didn't think of that. So I got in the van and I took off by myself. And I traveled for about 2 weeks. And I was in ecstasy. Of course, Krishna made all kinds of arrangements, but it was exciting because I was saying, let's go, Krishna, we're going. And, you know, he arranged everything else. We're never really alone. But it is nice to you know, depend on Krishna exclusively and just kind of be alone sometimes. Yes, two more on the internet, and then we have Vrindavan. Okay.
Two questions from Facebook. One is from Bhakta Adam Ellen Bass.
Oh, Bhakta Adam.
He's looking for some advice. If I struggle with giving up a last vestige of attachment to checking scores on ESPN, I feel terrible, but I really struggle to give it up since sports have been a pastime of mine like my whole life.
Yeah. No, that's understandable. Well, you know, try to see it in relationship to Krishna. Because, you know, ultimately, Prabhu, what's your name? Anu?
A-N-A-N-D, Anand.
Anand, good name for you.
Thank you.
Anand has brought up that anything could be connected to Krishna. So, you know, just shine a little light on it and try to connect it, like Anand was saying earlier. Why couldn't you try to see a sports team? Remember Krishna's pastimes going to wrestle. And where did wrestling come from? When Krishna and Balaram wrestled Mushtika and Chanura, and everyone was watching, and it was a big, exciting thing. And where did all this fighting come from? We just read the whole Ramayana together, and there's more fighting in that book than there is on CNN. You know, this is just remember the connection to Krishna. And when you do that, then the illusory aspect kind of goes away. And then gradually, you know, that idea of the heroes, you know, there's the heroes and then the attachment to who actually won. And you can analyze it also, like who actually won the game. First of all, I mean, let's say American football. It's not just... And I'm going to say some blasphemous things here, so if you don't want to hear it, you know, turn off your computer and don't listen to this. But actually, it's a very nasty thing. It's a very nasty thing because you're taking human body, which is very refined. It's such a refined instrument, especially the brain is so refined to think about higher matters. And it's exploitative because you're taking young people who really don't know any better, and if you give them, you know, $100,000 a year, they'll go out and perform for you. And I'm not saying they don't have any free will. They decide to, but it's very enticing. And they bash their heads in, literally. They get all kinds of, you know, incurable diseases, brain diseases from smashing their heads over and over again. What to speak of breaking limbs? I mean, some of the European guy was saying a few years ago, he said the reason that United States doesn't do as well, Winter Olympics and other things, you take all your best athletes, you put them in the NFL and let them smash themselves to bits. And it, you know, if you just think about it from a different point of view, what is the lifetime of a person when they get out of, say, the football league? The people that were linemen, that had trainers to get them huge and eat more and more so they could, you know, be powerful and strong and everything. And after they don't have any mentorship, they end up basically overeating and having all kinds of eating disorders, and no one really cares for them. I mean, if you look at the underbelly of certain things, it's not so nice. It's exploitative. It's really meant, ultimately, for the owners to make money and sell advertising. How does that sound, Bhakti Adam? I mean, and then if you see what's actually behind it, you know, and I don't know what scores you're looking at, but if you look at any of them, you can just pick it apart, analyze it, and see what's actually going on there. It's not so interesting. Just like Maya is always, if you look at it from a distance or you don't really look carefully, you'll think, you know, this is okay, or even looks really good. And this I learned when I was in grammar school. I saw, our teacher showed us a movie, and I can't even remember why or what class it was, but I do remember the movie. So there was a beautiful man and a beautiful woman. Apparently they were married, they're in the same house, and they were getting ready to go out for the night on a date or something. So it focused in on each one of them. So there was the man, and he was combing his hair, and he had a mustache or whatever, and, you know, everything. So he's, you know, and he looked pretty handsome. So then the movie camera said, think he looks handsome? Now let's look closer. And then the camera goes in, and they had some kind of, you know, special microscope where they can see into the pores of your hair and say, did you know that there are living entities that live within the pores of your hair? Let's look in his nose, you know, and then there's like, there's animals in there, you know, and then you start thinking like, oh, it's not what I thought it was. And then the woman, same thing. I won't go into the details, but I tell you one thing, you know, people, they spend billions of dollars to get nice hair. But if you're sitting in a restaurant somewhere and you find one hair in your soup, you'll never go back there, right? So that's Maya, because Maya's like, oh, it's very nice, but take a closer look. It's not so nice. It's actually, the Prabhupada calls it a colossal hoax. And, you know, there's not that many people that are calling that out. You can read all these so-called sophisticated writers in the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Washington Post. And they're not going to tell you that it's a colossal hoax because they have a vested interest in it. They want to stay here and enjoy the illusion. But a pure devotee is going to come and say, you know, you're being faked out. This whole thing is a fake out. So figure it out a little more deeply through hearing about it and take shelter of a sublime existence. So we had one more. I'm chewing up the clock, as they say in sports. Okay, go ahead.
This is from Anuradha Susevini Devi Dasi. Hare Krishna Prabhuji, Dandavat Pranams. What is the meaning of sincere chanting? Is there any yardstick to self-monitor oneself to understand whether I am sincere or not?
That is a really good question, because someone who asks that question is, you know, living on the threshold of sincerity or has already passed over the threshold and is in it. The very fact of asking the question, am I sincere, can I be sincere, or, you know, typically somebody who's chanting and they're thinking, I'm not sincere, Krishna, I wish I could be sincere. This is sincerity. And you'll know it when you feel it, because it feels, it's the most real feeling that there is that we have, is this sincerity. That you lay yourself bare before Krishna and you say, I actually want to surrender to you. And I can see it for myself. I can look at my desire and say, this is my full intention of surrender, even if I can't do it. Let me show you in the Bhagavad Gita 3:31. This is a case that might address several issues, but one of them is sincerity, and the other is, what do you do when you're not there yet? In other words, you want to be advanced in devotional service, but you're just not. you can be sincere and at the same time be inhibited by many kinds of obstacles. So this is 331. And in the purport, Prabhupada says, the injunction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna is the essence of all Vedic wisdom and therefore is eternally true without exception. So that's a nice start. And the verse itself is Krishna saying, my instruction is perfect, so just follow it. If you follow it, just don't be simple, don't be envious, and just follow it, you'll be successful. Then he goes on, does Prabhupada in the purport, as the Vedas are eternal, so this truth of Krishna consciousness is also eternal. One should have firm faith in this injunction without envying the Lord. There are many philosophers who write commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita but have no faith in Krishna. They will never be liberated from the bondage of fruitive action. But an ordinary man with firm faith in the eternal injunctions of the Lord, even though unable to execute such orders, becomes liberated from the bondage of the law of karma. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord, but because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely, without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. So it really means be without any pretense. The word sincere comes from this this very interesting origin where marble became a very expensive commodity at one point. And the best marble didn't have cracks in it. And there were some merchants who were pulling marble out and then refining it, and it had cracks in it, but then they would put colored wax to cover up the cracks. And then when they'd sell it later on, you know, the heat would come and the wax would come out, and you'd say, oh, the cracks were there all the time. So this word sinceri, which means without wax. So don't try to cover up all these things and make a pretense before Krishna, but just say, you know, I sincerely want to surrender to you, even though I'm doing a very poor job of it right now, but this is my full intention. It's a very important question and topic. It's the most important substance, sincerity. And if you can get even one drop of it, then your devotional practice will be successful. Okay, who is next? You help me. Vrindavan, yes.
So you're talking about Digvijay Pandit and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So I remember the story. Radha Maharaj was giving a lecture about Parthasarathi, who I think was Ramanujacharya's disciple. So there's a Digvijay Pandit coming to his town, and I forgot his name, but I know his name meant the one who knew everything. So he came, and Parthasarathi, he said he picked up a handful of sand and asked, if your name means everything, if you truly know everything, please answer how many grains of sand is in my hand. And the Digvijay Pandit was speechless, and his pride was crushed.
Yay. But you know what? You reminded me of why I started telling that story about the Brahmin's wives. It was because I was trying to get to Indra. And I'll just briefly say that after that pastime with the wives of the Brahmins, the very next day, this idea of the Indra Yajna started in Vrindavan. And Krishna saw that there were many men who were setting up for this Yajna. And he went over and asked his father, why are you doing this? And he said, to please Indra. And he asked, is it just a tradition, or is there actually something in Shastra, or what? He said, oh, we've always done it this way. And you know the story, so I'll cut to the end, but Krishna arranged to take away the sacrifices for Indra and have it all directed towards Govardhan Hill. And Indra got crushed by the whole experience because he became angry out of his pride and tried to kill everyone in Vrindavan. Krishna saved them by lifting up the hill. And afterwards, Indra came to ask for forgiveness, and you'll find that Krishna met him in a solitary place. And he did that just so that he didn't crush him. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur also explains that when Krishna met Indra in that secluded place, in his countenance, Krishna was saying, I'm sorry, I hope I didn't offend you or disturb you in any way. Because he's actually the kind friend of all living entities. So that's his kind nature. Okay, we had, yes, One, two. I'm sorry, you're next.
Thank you, Maharaj. In that sloka you were reading on the from Chaitanya Charitamrita, the Viraktir. So I was just thinking, so self-realized devotees sometimes they say they are Viraktir means like disgusted with some of the dealings of material worlds. And then it's also explained that they sometimes it doesn't bother them. They keep on go on with their duties, but it doesn't bother them. Are these like two different stages of spiritual advancement, or it is just some of the things they are disgusted with, but other things don't bother them?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, say that because I gave for the other ones, Virakti, the example given here by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is of Bharat Maharaj. Bharat Maharaj was a very popular king. In fact, the whole universe is named after him. And he had a beautiful wife, family, riches, untold power. And he gave it up. He went to the forest. And it wasn't even a major consideration for him. This was the Virakti aspect. Now, as to your question, sometimes Virakti is mentioned as that devotees are disgusted with the material world, and sometimes it's said they're not disgusted with the material world. So Krishna explains in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, when he's speaking to Uddhava, that people have different adhikaris, or different qualifications for taking to different paths. So what he says is, if somebody's completely disgusted with the material world, they're mostly suited, their adhikari is for Gyan Yoga. Because Gyan Yogis, they like this idea, the material world's completely disgusting, and therefore I won't touch it. And I'll keep analyzing it, so I'll stay away from it. And then the people that are very attracted to the material world, so their adhikari is for karma yoga. So they work in the world, they mix it up with work and everything and profits, but they learn to give it away to Krishna. It's the karma yoga. So then Krishna says, those who are not fully attached to the material world, or they're not completely disgusted by it, they're suited for the path of bhakti. This is the middle path of dedication. So also Krishna mentions in the Bhagavatam that there's a way in which at a phase of a devotee's life, he or she may be disgusted by the material world, but not be able to give it up. Doesn't have the power yet to give it up. But actually, those devotees who are very, very advanced, they don't see the world as different from Krishna. Like Prabodhananda Saraswati says, I see the whole material world as the abode of joy. And that goes to the point in the Bhagavatam also that there's only two people that are happy in this world. One person is the fool, because he doesn't know enough yet that the material world's illusion. He just thinks, like, this is it. And the other one is the person who's completely liberated. And everybody else in between, which is where the big numbers are, has to really suffer. Because they can see that I shouldn't be involved in this, but it's really difficult because they're not there yet. Okay, was there one last thing? Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you, Prabhu, for the class. One last I was thinking on is from Digvijay Pandit pastime, that how Srila Prabhupada also mentions in purport of the 7th canto that one should not ask for a benediction that one cannot maintain.
Yes.
So something on pride that, so.
Yeah, don't ask for benedictions that you can't handle. And we, as living entities, we really can't handle material benedictions. They're not meant for us. We should ask for something altogether spiritual. In fact, Prahlad Maharaj sets the standard for prayers. There's, of course, a lot of different prayers that are exemplary that we can follow. But Prahlad Maharaj says, if I ask for any benediction, let it be this. There be no more material desires within my heart. And then Prithu Maharaj also says, I don't know what to pray for because I'm attached. So you pretend you're my father and I don't know anything. I'm your son. You decide what's good for me and you just enact whatever that is and I'll take it. And we'll have a little chanting to end this session, and just at 8 o'clock then we'll have the Artik ceremony. So thank you everyone for coming out to ISV tonight on a Wednesday night and participating in this discussion. Hare Krishna.
Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, hey! Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman, Nacharyar Marman.